This classical conversation highlights music of Julia Perry and Coleridge Taylor Perkinson. Joining us for a discussion, we have violinist Curtis Stewart and conductor James Blatchley. They've co-curated an album called American Counterpoints, and so we are really lucky that we have this opportunity to have both of them here today. So, James and Curtis, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
We'll get to the album itself in just a moment, but I'd love to know a little bit more about both of you. Maybe, Curtis, if we could start with you as the soloist. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm kind of a native New Yorker. I was actually born in Helsinki, Finland, which is where my mom was studying. She's a violinist and composer as well. She went to the Sibelius Academy there, and her mom was an opera singer in the Warsaw National Opera. She grew up in Poland, but was of Greek heritage. So I was constantly kind of looking at my roots in these kind of multiply extended zones. My dad is also a jazz musician. He's a jazz tuba player, and he was on tour, and he met my mom in Finland, which is where I was born. And then they brought me back over here to New York, and I was just kind of in this wild, free jazz, new composition, New York, you know, wonderland. That's kind of where all my musical influence kind of extends into me. I went to school at the LaGuardia Performing Arts High School, then off to Eastman, got a degree in violin and mathematics, came back. After not getting to any of the grad schools of my dreams, I went into teaching, and I ended up teaching at LaGuardia Performing Arts High School, which is where my dad also taught. And then moved to Juilliard. I'm teaching chamber music there in some classes. And now I'm also the artistic director of the American Composers Orchestra and a member of Public Quartet, which is a new music and improvising string quartet. So the only reason I mention my parents is that I think a lot of people think of the music that I do as being somehow extremely outside of the box. But for me, it actually represents just an extension of exactly where I came from. It's as deep in the box that I came from as possible. So I'm searching for that more and more every day.
What a journey. Thank you for telling us a little bit about that. Yeah. And James, how about you? What's a little bit of your backstory?
Yeah, I was born in New York City, born and raised in Manhattan. And like Curtis said, musical wonderland, just a lot of wonderful experiences as a child, you know, I was performing. By the time I was five, I was performing on the stage of the Met. Actually, my first performance was walking out on stage as part of the American Ballet Theater, out onto the stage of the Met. And I think from that moment on, I was hooked. You know, just have always loved performing. I was a violinist actually as a child. I was the concertmaster for my youth orchestra, which is Interschool Orchestras of New York. Shout out to that wonderful organization. I ended up conducting a youth orchestra with Interschool many years later. But in between that time, I became a composer. My first master's degree was in composition. While I was at Oberlin Conservatory, I explored a lot of different genres. I was in the big band, the OJE, Oberlin Jazz Ensemble, under the direction of the great Wendell Logan. I performed, you know, violoni. I played double bass and, you know, the gut string violoni with period instruments and viola da gamba, and, you know, played piano. And so just had a very wide-ranging musical experience. You know, I started composing more earnestly at Oberlin and had 13 works performed my senior year, including a ballet that was fully produced, and sang professionally when I was in New York City in my first few years out of college. I was singing, tuning pianos, doing all sorts of things, teaching with Carnegie Hall, New York Philharmonic. And so just a lot of different experiences that led me to realize through my own kind of coaching of my own compositions that I loved working with musicians and sculpting and shaping and exploring colors and writing music directly for my incredible colleagues was such a great joy. And eventually people were saying, look, you really know what you want and you should probably consider conducting not just your own music, but but other people's music. And so that kind of lit a fire for me, and I got my second master's degree in conducting, but started conducting fairly late, in my mid to late 20s. Some conductors start very, very early and always have a dream of doing this. I really didn't. Conducting is an outgrowth of my love of working with and collaborating with musicians, and exploring music as a, I guess, scholar as well as interpreter, and then ultimately just loving performing and advocating for composers other than myself proved to be quite a fulfilling career.
So then, how did you and Curtis join forces for this album, American Counterpoint? How did that, what was the start of that project like?
Well, the very start is that Curtis and I have worked together for probably almost 15 years, during the course of some of the prequels to the Experiential Orchestra. We had other orchestral projects, and Curtis was a part of some of those, including Mahler Symphony in 2012, and The Rite of Spring Dance Party, and some other really memorable concerts. And so I knew Curtis as an extraordinary violinist and great collaborator. And then I heard his album of Power, and just was floored by that incredible, prophetic music making. I've never heard, anything quite like it. Curtis is, has a unique voice, and his directness, was just overwhelming. And we ran into each other in New York one winter day, and I was at the time looking for a collaborator for the Violin Concerto of Giulia Peri. I had looked into the work and had been studying it from the manuscript, which is written in kind of shaky hand because Giulia Peri, lost the use of her right hand side of her body, and so some of her revisions were in that the left hand notation, which is very hard to read. But and it's just an extraordinary piece. And I talked to Curtis, and I don't know. It turns out that he had been exploring Giulia Peri as well, and it was kind of, looking back on it, it was like it was meant to be. But I guess there were some decisions to be made. It just felt inevitable at a certain point, and we started exploring the work together, and it's been an amazing journey.
How fortuitous. Yeah, that Giulia Peri Violin Concerto, has that been recorded before?
No, this is the world premiere recording.
World premiere. How exciting. How would you say this concerto is similar to or different to traditional concertos?
Well, we'll start with different. It starts with a cadenza, 3 minute cadenza, and ends with essentially another multi-minute cadenza. It's also different because it's in 17 different metronome markings, or there's only really three, but there's 17 time changes, which is unusual. It's also unusual because it's all built on two intervals, so it's like a theme and variations in a way, or like a free rhapsodic treatment of exploration, I guess, of those intervals and the kind of implications of those intervals, and also the intervals, the distance between those intervals is also explored quite rather extensively. So it's both kind of autobiographical, as I think Curtis and I might speak to, as well as extremely rigorous compositionally. So I don't know, Curtis, you've played more violin concertos than I have. I've conducted a few, but do you find it to be similar or different to anything else that you've played?
I guess some similarities. I mean, in the final cadenza, something about it reminds me quite a bit of the Shostakovich concerto. There's a cadenza in the middle of, it's like a third movement, or actually a fifth movement of that concerto, between the third and fourth movements, that is extremely extended and quite compositionally robust. And it accelerates into this massive, it just keeps getting faster and faster and higher and higher. It really reminds me of the final cadenza in the Peri Concerto, reminds me of that very exciting cadenza from the Shostakovich Concerto. But other than that, it really does not remind me of anything. There's one moment in the middle that kind of has a kind of Bernsteinian quality of romanticism. And that's like kind of a peak moment. That's like, a moment peeking out of the clouds. The rest of the piece is quite somber and introspective. I would say the harmonies are thorny, but very expressive in that they're, I think, meant to be sung. They're meant to be felt. There's a lot of angularity and kind of expressive discomfort in the piece. There's a lot of mystery, and I think, I mean, you get a little bit of that in like a Sibelius concerto or a Bartok concerto or something, but I think this really goes there. So it, just expressively, it's in a totally different realm. And I mean, I just find that Julie Perry, you know, she'll take a motivic theme like an interval or a rhythm and or a harmonic element and twist it and turn it and make it turn it into all the little find all the variations and all the nooks and crannies that she can pull out of that theme. But in addition to just musical ingenuity, I think expressively the piece just spans the gamut of just wild pain to kind of idyllic, dreamlike romanticism. So it is in that way it is also kind of different than many other concertos in that it. Like it, you know, in a way, the Beethoven concerto is known for its kind of depth, and you find all these different emotions in there. I think this concerto is in that realm of variety and depth, and just because things are because there is so much, it's almost like watching someone speak. It's like listening to someone's confession, in a way. There's so many shades to it. It's not variety just for variety's sake. It's variety because the way someone speaks authentically would naturally be have so many shades, and you hear all these sides to the story. And I think that's what she's able to capture with this concerto.
Do you think that expressive discomfort you were talking about, do you think that's present in the other pieces on the album as well, or how are those complementary?
I think the whole album explores the nature of modernism. Both composers are writing in the late tw 20th century, and I mean Coleridge Taylor Perkinson is writing a bit in the early 21st century, but is steeped in the traditions and the techniques of the late 20th. And I think that sense of modernism kind of embraces the discomfort, embraces dissonance, embraces angularity as both expression and beauty. And so you find all these novel kind of imagined effects that come from just pure harmony. There are some tracks on this album that are purely tonal, like for example, Ye Who Seek the Truth. Is extremely, it almost sounds like a Bach chorale. The prelude for strings is a just rich, beautiful kind of tapestry of sound, but it has inklings of that modernism and that harmonic discomfort. You can kind of hear these little pangs. It's almost like Perry knew what was going to happen. And I mean, that's kind of ironic that the piece is called Prelude. In that it, you know, it is it. I mean that, it is both a harmonic prelude to where she's going later in her life as a composer, as well as a prelude to what happens in her life. So it, yes, it does pervade the album pretty deeply.
James, I'd be interested to hear your perspective on some of the different tracks too, and why you felt like you wanted these to be together, included as a set on the album.
Yeah, I mean this whole album is a very organic outgrowth of the collaboration between Curtis and I of co-creating, co-curating a concert actually that we gave in December of 2022, that we had been planning actually for even earlier. So the process began probably in, you know, spring of 2022 of curating that concert. And you know, it's just an exploration of music that we felt would lead organically to the violin concerto and help listeners kind of approach the work. Because I think if you go directly, you know, to the track that starts the violin concerto, it's a different listening experience than if you allow the album to kind of precede and carry you there, and prepare you for Perry's unique musical language. And we wanted to have her music and the music of Coleridge Taylor Perkinson kind of speak to each other, have a dialogue. And after we recorded the album, and we already had kind of the order pretty much set, that's when the title started emerging in discussions with Curtis and I. And it felt like it really fit the purpose of what we were going for, which is to have these pieces each speak to each other and, you know, trade off, you know, a piece of that starts the album, which is one of Curtis's signature pieces to play, Louise in a Blue Strut, a cakewalk of Coleridge Taylor Perkinson, you know, written for Sanford Allen, the New York Philharmonic, this incredible piece that's, you know, so rooted in culture of, you know, I guess the very complex and but the history of the cakewalk itself, but then have that feed into and speak to Julia Perry's Prelude, which was written when she was 22 years old, and is a really early piece, but it's also representative, I think, of her style throughout her life, which is to have, you know, harmonic complexity, some formal clarity, and there's a certain commitment to the means that she gives herself, you know, a compositional technique that I think is extremely strong and rigorous throughout her career. Once she sets her mind to something, she sticks to it, and she has a strength and an integrity to her composition that I think is almost unmatched. But in other ways, it's an early piece. But then we have that piece speak directly to another a very early piece by Coleridge Taylor Perkinson, which is his Sinfonietta Number 1 for strings, and that piece is a total tour de force. You know, I mean, it feels longer than it is because it's a whole journey. You know, and these three movements are all just extraordinary. And you know, I think Coleridge Taylor Perkinson was one of the greatest talents this country has ever known, and is tremendously under celebrated compared to what he should be. You know, certainly in our view. And I think it's starting to be understood just how brilliant he was, and the compositions that he left us, I think, are starting to enter more and more, you know, the programming across the country. But this is a real, really extraordinary piece, and a great vehicle for experiential orchestra. You know, the string players of experiential orchestra to kind of show what they've got, and to celebrate, you know, Perkinson's genius. And then that leads to, you know, pieces of Julia Perry that we think prepare the listener for the concerto. So the Symphony Number 1, sorry, the Symphony in One Movement for violas and basses, you know, very unusual choice of instrumentation, but most things about Julia Perry are unusual. You know, almost every composition by Julia Perry has something that is not common. And so to choose violas and basses as her, you know, soloists for this composition are tremendous and wonderful, and the color is so perfectly written for the colors of those instruments, and it's really rhythmically exciting piece, and you can see some of the kind of gnarly, intricate, wonderfully complex, interlocking rhythms that she utilizes in that piece will then kind of inform how you hear the concerto itself. And the Ye Who Seek the Truth, is, as Curtis said, you know, very tonal, singable. It's an early piece, 1952, and speaks to her training as a choral singer at Westminster Choir College, where she was the pitch giver for 2 years in a row. Pitch giver at Westminster is essentially the concertmaster, you know, the chosen to be, you know, the student who is the, you know, strongest musician. She held that honor, and you know, she just has such an amazing history. When you read about her life and her training and her early success, it's really amazing. And so we wanted to include a piece that featured that, and that's an arrangement by Janina Norpoth, who's a colleague of Curtis's at Public Quartet, but also one of the most accomplished arrangers of our time. So we're very honored to have her work on the album. And then all of that leads to, you know, the violin concerto. So by the time you get there, we hope that these two composers have kind of spoken to each other, and that the music, you get some context for Perry's musical language that leads to this violin concerto, which, while it was composed between 1963 and 1968, was revised in 1977, just 2 years before she died. And to me, that speaks to how important this piece was to her, to take that effort and revise a piece that had really no chance of getting performed at that point in her life, and had, she never heard it performed. She knew the value of it, despite the fact that there was really no performance opportunities for her music at the time. And so that kind of conviction, despite what she was living and experiencing, towards the end of her life, is really inspiring and compelling, and I think speaks to the value she placed on this work, and that we certainly hear, the excellence in the music. So, we hope that this whole thing takes us on a journey. But it ends, the last track is Curtis's amazing composition, "We Who Seek," and hopefully he can speak a little bit to that.
I've never belonged. Have you? Want to? Do I need a place on your wall?
Curtis, your piece, your composition there at the end. What did you have in mind when you wrote this?
Well, I was thinking about the idea of the album. So that was written in November. So we recorded the album in September. We had all these conversations about the track list and the title in October. And the We Who Seek was written in November. This just passed November. A couple weeks before we had to submit the metadata for the album. So we got it done. And the reason for that is it uses samples from the edited audio, so the pre-master audio from our recording session in September. It kind of chops and weaves both Julia Perry and Coleridge Taylor Perkinson's works together, along with a lyric paraphrase of the lyrics of "Ye Who Seek the Truth," and then a response verse from me that I created based on, I guess, the conversations that James and I have had as counterpoints as well about the album and the project. So one big conversation that we've been talking about is the idea of monoliths, and as a Black creative and composer, I think we're constantly faced with what people think we do. So I love the idea that Julia Perry and Coleridge Taylor Perkinson are both these tremendous composers in their own right. They're very distinct. They both happen to be Black composers, and they both tell a story about two of many approaches to writing quote unquote classical music at that time. Julia Perry is an extreme, almost academic, but with like rigorous, a very rigorous composer. I say that she's academic in the best of senses, in that she takes an idea and she, that is the idea that the whole piece is made of. It can all be traced back to very specific ideas. It's almost like a thesis while still being quite expressive and emotional. Coleridge Taylor Perkinson has that same harmonic rigor, in that he's really trying things and has a lot of ingenuity, and he is kind of framing his music in reference to style. The sinfonietta, it has a neo-baroque quality. His blues strut is very steeped in the blues. There are many of his other, he used to do work with arrangements for Marvin Gaye and Max Roach in the jazz world. So he's, his work is in relation to style, where it seems like Julia Perry's work is in relation to kind of just intervals and variation and things like that. So I love diffusing the monolithic aspect of what we think of as a Black composer. And that is partially what the verse deals with. It also deals with just the concept. I think "Ye Who Seek the Truth" is actually the perfect, there's a lyric in there that we must forgive those that seek the truth, because they are, they're just trying to follow in the footsteps of the Lord, essentially. And I think James and I are not necessarily following in the footsteps of the Lord with this album, but what we are doing is we are seeking some form of truth in these composers. We're looking for something that speaks to us. We're looking for something that speaks to the American moment of that the time that they were both writing. And there's so many more composers out there that were writing at that time. I mean, I'm being part of the American Composers Orchestra, we'll put out a call for scores and receive maybe 400 applicants every single time with every application pool in a year. And so I'm imagining just how many composers didn't apply to our thing. I'm imagining how many there are around the world every year. And then thinking back to that time period when Julia Perry and Coleridge Taylor Perkins were writing, and just thinking about how many composers must have existed during that time, and therefore how many have existed since then and now and before. And there is a lot of truth to be seek to be what is the past tense of seek? There's a lot of truth to be sook. I guess it's a call for more. And I would love to see some of the other violinists of our time pick up this Perry concerto and do it justice in their own way. I think there's so much information and juice to be squeezed out of this piece. And I think if I can do it, you can do it. I mean, it's a really hard piece. It like really tests the bounds of violin ability. There's all these double stops that kind of jump rapidly from low to high positions, and it's all supposed to be quite, it feels like it needs to be sung despite all these technical challenges. And so it's a real challenge to the artist to make it speak on the stage.
I think given your vision for this music, it feels very fitting that it was recorded by the Experiential Orchestra. And would you say, James, that you're wanting the audience to experience that search for truth? Or what do you hope they'll take away?
Well, we try not to be prescriptive of what our audience will experience. I always want to honor the one of the great aspects of music that's composed and improvised is that every listener takes something different from the experience of listening. I love that a husband and wife or a husband of a wife and wife of decades, 30, 40, 50 years, people who know each other extremely well can sit down and listen to the same concert, the same piece of music, and have completely different experiences. It's just so wonderful how different it can be. So I know that people will hear this album in a lot of different ways. What I hope they'll take from it is an appreciation of the quality and brilliance and genius of these composers. I hope that we have done some justice to the music that we have recorded and shared with the world through this album, and that people will perform these pieces and others by these composers more frequently. To Curtis's point, I hope that this is, part of a broader statement, which is that there's so much more to explore. And I would say in some of the research I've done over the past 7 or 8 years, specifically how much more music there is by historical composers of African descent, composers who were pushed aside, marginalized, neglected, for many different ways, kept off of the concert hall stages. Just that there's so much more to look into and to perform and to celebrate. Definitely, as Curtis says, there's many composers of our time who similarly deserves to be celebrated and performed. So there's just a lot of music to explore. I guess my general feeling is just, to appreciate the abundance we have of incredible music. These two composers in particular speak to me, I think. And to Curtis as well, probably for in different ways, but my background is in Renaissance counterpoint, so that's what I was raised in. My father is a conductor of a Renaissance a cappella choir, so Josquin and Akyem Dufay, these are the composers that I first encountered. And so the contrapuntal richness that we find in Carlos Taylor Perkinson, the compositional strength and the capacity that Perry has to these are things that speak to me as a musician. But yeah, what do I hope people take away? I hope they enjoy it. I hope they appreciate the brilliance of the music and the beauty of the music, and perhaps it spurs further exploration to look into how much more we have to celebrate.
Yeah, some people that we've spoken to have suggested that this Julia Perry piece isn't actually an important piece, important work, not necessarily just not only because of the composition, but because of when it was written, and just the expression kind of speaks to something important. That's what I think. Like, people are getting the vibe of importance, the emotion of importance from it. I think about why that might be. I think about what she was going through, what the country was going through in the 60s and 70s. I think about what she was going through at that time. Having had the stroke, she lost the use of her right side, had to learn to use the left side, is moving through that, really still, despite all that's going on in her world, she's still pushing through this. And for me, it was actually quite important. Two, it's important to s mention that for me, because, I mean, for anybody that's been a caretaker, I was a caretaker for my mom for 4 years, and she had a brain she had brain cancer, so she was a composer, and I and she was she too was trying to move through all the difficulties of that, and it overcame her. It was not She was a massively energetic and passionate person, and it took over. But with Perry, it didn't. She continued. She pushed through this thing. She got the piece. It's out in the world. 50 years later, we are now playing it. And for anybody going through something like that, I think you could potentially relate to that sense of importance. Not that So what you're going to do now, 50 years will be, in the annals of history. That's not what I mean by that. I just mean that what you do now is incredibly important, no matter what you happen to be going through. And for me, it's impossible for me not to project my own experiences and my own want to kind of take care of this music, kind of similarly to how I took care of my own mom. Just because it's like impossible for me not to project that energy onto this music. And so I'm not sure what I hope people get out of it, but I hope they feel empowered on some level that, no matter what you're going through, that it is truly important for you to continue. That something beautiful can come out of it.
Thank you so much for sharing that and for personalizing it even more. I think from here we can let the music speak for itself, but I'm so glad that we had a chance to talk to both of you to get a little more context. And I just wanted to say congratulations on the release as well.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.